Tammy Shipley believed someone was out to hurt her.
I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe.
She's put under 24-hour surveillance.
I tried to get in contact multiple times.
I just need to make a phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
And then something strange happens.
She just drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of pure water.
Ambulance emergency.
I've got a woman unconscious.
Tammy's story. Search Background Briefing on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wandering Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, 10 months after Vanuatu awkwardly stood up Prime Minister Anthony Albanese on signing a new security pact, both sides have finally inked the deal. So what does it mean for Australia and the region?
There's some serious significant wins on this agreement. It's a much more far-reaching agreement. You know, it talks about areas of cooperation in climate change, in economic transformation, in resilient infrastructure, security and stability as well. But there's also a really big cultural dimension which speaks to, I think, the maturing of the relationship between Australia and Vanuatu.
You're going to hear from that expert, the government and the federal opposition. Then we'll turn to chaos in South Africa.
It has led some people to make threats on social media that should any undocumented immigrant be found on or after the 30th of June, they will be subjected to violence.
So how is social media driving anti-immigration sentiment in South Africa? That story later on. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap.
Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, a landmark agreement that was set to transform the relationship between Australia and Vanuatu today is hanging in the balance. The $500 million Nakamal Agreement was originally set to be signed today, with Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese heading to Vanuatu's capital port, Vila, this morning. But now insiders say the signing ceremony might not happen. So joining us now to discuss...
So that was the reporting from the ABC's Pacific Beat program 10 months ago. When this pact was meant to be signed. It was a pretty awkward moment back then, as the federal government was trying to show its increasing strength in the region. But now it is claiming a win, because it has finally inked this deal. In a ceremony in Canberra yesterday, attended by leaders from both Australia and Vanuatu, the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, says that this Nakamal Agreement protects security and sovereignty, while also making Australia a preferred development partner.
Our agreement reflects and confirms Australia's role as Vanuatu's largest and most comprehensive economic, security and development partner, a responsibility that we take seriously.
That's the PM speaking yesterday in Canberra. So this deal has been watered down. It's dropped a clause aimed at limiting Chinese investment in infrastructure across Vanuatu. So what else does it include, and is it still worthwhile for both sides? Oliver Nobetow has worked with governments in the Pacific, including the government of PNG. He's now the acting director of the Lowy Institute's Pacific Islands program. He came on with Mel this morning, and that was the question that she asked him. If this agreement is of value to both Australia and Vanuatu?
Yeah, absolutely. The 10-month sort of deferment from last year that we saw, I think, was a way of coming to an agreement that both of the parties are happy with. And there's some serious significant wins on this agreement. What you'll find first is that the last agreement that was signed between Australia and Vanuatu was a bilateral security agreement back in 2022, but that was never ratified. Concerns around sovereignty, but also being narrow. And what we've ended up with now with that Nakamal is that it's a much more far-reaching agreement. You know, it talks about areas of cooperation in climate change, in economic transformation, in resilient infrastructure, security and stability as well. But there's also a really big cultural dimension which speaks to, I think, the maturing of the relationship between Australia and Vanuatu. We've never seen an agreement which sort of acknowledges Australia's history as a blackbird as it relates to the people of Vanuatu as well. So I think that sort of deep understanding with each other shows that the bilateral relationship is sort of entering into a new phase of being mature, but a really good partnership as well.
Yeah, that does seem to be a key feature across a number of deals that Australia is striking with Pacific neighbours. We can come to a bit more of that in a moment, but I do want to talk a bit more about the parameters that Australia was looking for, wanting to limit Chinese militarisation in the region. And through this, Australia was wanting to limit Chinese investment in Vanuatu's ports and airports and telecommunications. Where we seem to have landed with this treaty is Vanuatu saying it will consult with Australia on any planned third-party engagement on this kind of critical infrastructure. Do you think that achieves Australia's aim of wanting to keep China out of those areas of critical infrastructure?
Yeah, look, I think at the end of the day, what Australia was sort of hoping for is like, it's better to sign agreement than no agreement at all. Mm. And what we've landed with the obligation to consult, is going to be good. The key area, which does feature heavily in the agreement where Australia wanted to combat China, was through critical infrastructure. Now, as we heard with that sort of snippet of Albanese talking, right, there was a big concern around sovereignty and the respect for sovereignty. So I think allowing for the extension that Vanuatu will consult was as far as it was willing to go. And I think Australia was happy to sort of go away with that. Now, obviously, we know that this is happening concurrently with another agreement that's being consulted between Vanuatu and China called the Namela Agreement. Now, what's been stated in sort of official statements is largely a development agreement. When we see how this sort of plays out, I think what both of the governments are looking forward to is once they establish what's called a Nakamal Committee, that they will be able to have sort of that free-flowing conversation and have a better idea of where that partnership will be. But yeah, I think what was hoped for 10 months ago was to have a much sort of stronger say in the third-party engagement in these areas, on these critical infrastructure areas. That's not what we've landed on, but we still have a bit of a favourable position, which can be sort of a foundational level where the partnership can build from there.
Oliver Nobertau there, the acting director of the Lowy Institute's Pacific Islands program. So that is where we picked up the conversation with Australia's Minister for the Pacific, Pat Conroy. Mel asked him what the third-party consultation process would actually involve.
The thought process there is that when other development partners want to invest in infrastructure in our region, it's important that countries in the Pacific understand what they're getting, understand both the opportunities and also the risks that poses. So our requirement to consult is merely talking to us about what they're planning and also us providing planning and technical assistance around that infrastructure.
So this is consultation before decision-making or before a decision is made on development that relates to critical infrastructure.
Absolutely. And it's very dangerous to get into hypotheticals, but these clauses are obviously constructed so that if there's infrastructure that could be potentially militarised, that there's an opportunity through the Nakamal Committee, which is Implementation Committee of the Treaty, to talk that through so that both parties understand what that infrastructure is and what it doesn't do, how it can be free from foreign interference and how there's no danger of it being militarised, because that's really important in our region. We're in the middle of a great power contest in our region. It's really important that we don't have foreign military bases in the Pacific.
We know that Vanuatu is also negotiating the details of an arrangement with China that will look largely at economic issues, but nonetheless go to the depth of their relationship. Do you expect to be able to see the contents of that agreement when it's finalised?
Well, Prime Minister Napat said yesterday in the press conference that they would release that, and we welcome it. We always release our agreements and we call for every other country to release their agreements with their international partners.
This has been an issue with Solomon Islands who have said they cannot release their agreement with China.
Yeah, absolutely. Prime Minister Napat has said that they will release it. And in the Solomon Islands agreement, my understanding is there's a legal prohibition, but that can be waived if both parties agree to it. So if both parties were open to it, I would certainly encourage that. On Vanuatu, Prime Minister Napat's made it very clear that it's the development agreement. And secondly, any agreement that Vanuatu signs subsequent to Nakamal must be consistent with it. And Nakamal prioritises Australian policing assistance, prohibits foreign military bases. So any agreement post it has to be consistent with it, and that's why we've got a degree of comfort. And we've been very clear with the Pacific, you can have partnerships with other development partners. We don't claim ownership over the Pacific. We're privileged to be the biggest development partner, but other countries have an interest. They should do it in a way that's consistent with Pacific security, not undermining Pacific security.
Minister, Anthony Albanese is widely expected to sign a new treaty with Fiji next week. Can you confirm that treaty is at the point where it's ready to be signed by leaders?
I can confirm that Prime Minister Albanese is travelling to Fiji in the Solomon Islands as part of our huge effort to improve relations with the region that have really paid dividends over the last 4 years. We're still negotiating the Vivale Treaty and we're hopeful of concluding it, but I'm not going to get ahead of the Prime Minister, but I'm very confident that our relationship will be even stronger with Fiji. Prime Minister Rambuka and Prime Minister Albanese get on really well. They've had some really good progress. They've both driven the Oceans of Peace concept that Prime Minister Rambuka has pioneered through the Pacific Island Forum, and I'm hopeful that our relationship will get even closer very shortly.
And we've heard the Solomon Islands Prime Minister Matthew Wale talk about the idea of a regional security pact. That's something that the opposition here has said it supports the idea of. We know that Mr. Wale has been discussing that idea with the PNG's Prime Minister, James Marape. What's the Australian government's thinking on that at this point?
Well, of course, we're open to it. We're always driven by what the Pacific sets as its priorities, but we live every day according to the 2022 PIF leaders communique, which said Pacific security must come from within. If there's any gaps in Pacific security, it should be filled by other Pacific countries, including Australia. That's why we've got the alliance with PNG. That's why we've landed landmark treaties with Tuvalu, Nauru, and Vanuatu. And we're getting on with it.
Yep.
And if the regional agreement is in the interest of the Pacific, then we'll help support that. But ultimately, we're in their hands and they're all sovereign nations and we respect that, and that's really important.
That is Australia's Minister for the Pacific, Pat Conroy, there. So what do the other side of politics here in Australia actually make of this pact? The Shadow Foreign Minister is Ted O'Brien, and as well as discussing a couple domestic Liberal Party issues, Mel started with this story on Vanuatu.
This Nakamal pact that has now been signed, sealed and delivered, is this a good outcome for Australia?
Look, I think anything that will deepen our relationships with Pacific Island nations is a good thing. The coalition certainly has given this agreement its in principle support. We now look forward to examining the detail. There's no doubt that we need to continue to build on the work of multiple governments that's come before, and that is to ensure that the Pacific Island acts as an island, as a united area, I should say, not as one island, but multiple islands. And Australia is part of that.
Mm.
You know, often Australians don't realise that, but we are a Pacific nation, and the more that we can work with our Pacific family, the better.
Ted, just turning briefly to some more domestic issues, the coalition continues to have record low support in the polling. What was the point of replacing Susan Lee if it's not helping the position of the coalition in the eyes of voters?
Oh, look, I'll let others run commentary on previous leadership battles, Mel. Our job right now is we have Australians who are becoming poorer by the day, and only the coalition is offering a fundamental shift in our tax policy that is going to deliver the greatest tax cuts in a generation to Australians. They are the sorts of messages we need to get out there to the Australian people. We are going to have families who are finally going to have their real wages increasing after decreases over the years. These are the things, you know, you can talk polls, you can talk leadership ballots. Ultimately, hand on heart, I believe the Australian people are more interested in their day-to-day life, and I believe they are becoming poorer under the Albanese government. And what we have in the coalition is a team with a plan, and that's the plan that we need to speak about.
The plan doesn't seem to be resonating, though. This is the problem. Like, is Melissa McIntosh right that you need a rebrand, that the policy's right, but there needs to be a rebrand of the process?
Well, while that's not my proposal, I think what Melissa is getting at is right in that we need to communicate our plan. And Mel, that's why, with all respect, I'm pushing back on some of these questions about wanting to talk polling and leadership. Right now, the Australian people are poorer They're poorer than they were years ago. We've had the biggest drop in living standards in the advanced world. Real wages have gone backwards, productivity backwards. We're nearly at $1 trillion in debt. We've got 10 years of deficits ahead of us. These are serious issues affecting the day-to-day lives of Australians. Now, what's the plan to get out of that? The plan is the biggest, most consequential tax reform by the Taylor government. That is what's going to happen here, because we want more discussion
about that tax plan, less discussion on issues like multiculturalism and monoculturalism and that debate?
I want to make sure that we are talking about what matters to the Australian people, and I believe that's their day-to-day life. I want to have less discussion about polling. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the Australian people. It's only the coalition that has a positive plan to actually build this nation up, to ensure families are looked after, small businesses are looked after, to ensure we are empowering people. We're empowering the individual, not creating big government. That it's only the Liberal Party, together with the Nationals, that are actually talking like this. And that is why us communicating this is so clear. Now, I'll back the government when it does good things in the Pacific.
Yep.
I will give them credit where it's due. But when it comes to what they're doing to the Australian people, I'm sorry, this Albanese government is actually making our country weaker, poorer and more dependent. And we need to call that out, because only the coalition has a team and a plan to turn this around. And that's what I want to focus on.
Ted O'Brien there, the Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs, also the former Liberal Party Deputy Leader in Susan Lee's opposition, discussing all things Liberal Party, but also that pact that Australia has just signed with Vanuatu. But we're going to end on a story that's not really been topping the headlines all around the world, but it is one that we've wanted to get into. In South Africa, protest groups are demanding that all undocumented foreigners leave the country by today, the 30th of June, ahead of anti-immigration rallies that many are fearing could turn violent. Anti-migrant rhetoric has been intensifying there in recent months. It's been fueled by groups on social media blaming foreign nationals for taking jobs, committing crimes, also straining public services. Daniel Stain has been following this. He is the deputy editor of the non-profit news agency Ground Up. It's based in Cape Town. And he walked us through what is quite a complex story, but I reckon he was able to explain it pretty well.
So over the past few months, we've seen a rise in anti-immigrant sentiment on social media. And one of the groups that seems to have been leading the campaign is a group called March and March. And now it's a relatively new group that has been quite mysterious in how they've been made up and who they consist of. But there appear to be links to the former president of South Africa, Jacob Zuma, and his political party, although those to what extent he's actively involved is not clear. And this anti-immigration group has been leading an online campaign and organizing marches and demonstrations in several cities and rural towns throughout South Africa. And as that has gained traction with more people joining, they set a deadline for the 30th of June. For what exactly their demand is quite unclear, but the one demand seems to be that all undocumented immigrants leave the country by the 30th of June, but they've later said they don't want everyone to leave by the 30th of June. They at least want the government to satisfy them that the government is taking illegal immigration seriously. But in that confusion, it has led some people to make threats on social media that should any undocumented immigrant be found on or after the 30th of June, they will be subjected to violence or evicted from their homes, etc. And that has caused absolute chaos in the past few days. We've seen tens of thousands of undocumented immigrants from Malawi, for example, and Mozambique, as well as Zimbabwe, fleeing from their homes and gathering at locations in Durban, one of our main cities, and as well as Cape Town. And these are people who have left their jobs, left their homes, some having left their children behind, saying that it's too risky for them to be around after the 30th of June, as well as people who have been kicked out of their homes by landlords who say that it's too risky to have them around, or employers who advise their undocumented immigrant employees to rather go home back to Malawi, Mozambique, Zimbabwe. So basically there's been this hype created on social media, this amorphous deadline of the 30th of June, and that's caused severe suffering actually for tens of thousands of immigrant families in the country.
Yeah, it must be quite terrifying for those families. We have seen attacks on foreign nationals before in South Africa, but what's driving it this time?
Yeah, so South Africa has a long history of what we call xenophobia or Afrophobia, of local South Africans discriminating against, attacking verbally and physically immigrants from other African countries. What is slightly different this time is the role of social media. Basically, social media is driving this new wave of anti-immigrant sentiment, and there appear to be, just in terms of the patterns and the role of bots on X and Facebook and so on, as well as the role of paid influencers, there appears to be some coordination behind it, although that doesn't make it any less chaotic. And there have kind of been copycat protests popping up that have been extremely violent in the past few weeks. We've seen at least two people being killed in Mossel Bay on the coast, as well as one person killed a week ago in Pietermaritzburg.
You mentioned people have had to flee from their homes and where they're living. So have there been makeshift camps being set up as people figure out where to go and what to do? What are the circumstances people have found themselves in?
Yeah, I must say the response from our government has been quite remarkable. They've been faced with an unprecedented situation in Durban, for example, with these families that have just fled from their homes and gathered in certain camps that have organically grown. And these are all mostly people from Malawi who have arrived in South Africa over the past few years without the proper documentation to live and work in South Africa. So the government in a tight spot, because now the government has to process every single one of these people. The police has been screening them to make sure that none of them are wanted for crimes, you know, that they might not just be hopping on the bandwagon to get out of the country and escape justice. And our Department of Home Affairs has then been checking the people's documents, seeing if they've been in the country unlawfully. If so, they need to be issued with a notice that they're not allowed to come back into the country for the next 5 years. And then they've been handed over to the Malawian High Commission, an unprecedented situation, an extremely difficult situation for the government to be in. And it seems that the government has made all their resources available to make sure it happens quickly. And at the same time, humanitarian organizations are absolutely fantastic, stepping in, providing food, providing shelter, health services at these kind of makeshift repatriation camps.
Daniel Stain there, the deputy editor of the non-profit news agency Ground Up, which is based in Cape Town in South Africa. I reckon we might have to stay on that story tomorrow. Well, thank you so much for listening to all of those interviews from Mel Clark. They were produced by the Radio National Breakfast team. And the Breakfast Wrap was today produced by Eddie Diamond and Katie McAllister. I'm Luke Siddham-Dundon. We'll see you back here, same time, same place, tomorrow. And as always, you can get live interviews from Radio National Breakfast every morning at 6 a.m. on the wireless and also ABC Listen. But we are with you later on in the day on all your favourite podcast platforms and Radio National. Until then, have a good one.